This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Attention Earthlings, Adrian Parr has a new book for you called Earthlings, Imaginative Encounters with the Natural World. You can't fit this book or Adrian into any box. She sounds like an Australian-American with a European education, perhaps. The new work follows her trilogy of three works, Hijacking Sustainability, Wrath of Capital, and The Birth of New Earth. All the while, Adrian is educating people, directly with leading roles at the universities of Cincinnati and Texas. She is now Dean of the College of Design at the University of Oregon. Adrian Parr, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So you have advised on city planning and design, and now we find cities are just not designed for extreme rainfall and record-smashing heat. In a super heat wave, for example, there's hardly any shade. The glass offices have no windows. Everybody depends on cooling. Are we not life dependent, literally, on the power grid and whoever controls that?
Good question. Well, we rely on the power grid and a whole gamut of infrastructure. So you mentioned flooding, and this is directly tied to stormwater infrastructure systems and also, you know, the impermeable surfacing that's blanketing the land. And hard infrastructure, replacing like important wetlands, for example. So in terms of the power grid, I think the biggest challenge here is how do we shift the energy source that drives the grid from dirty to clean energy with one that's powered, you know, by renewable energy, for example. So we have the know-how how to make that shift. I think we just need the will to do it. For example, you know, the electricity that powers like Burlington, Vermont or Aspen, Colorado are now, you know, from 100% renewable energy. So if we put together a variety of different sorts of clean energy sources, we can sort of get across the finishing line. And here I'm thinking like a biomass, solar, wind power, and so on and so forth. And
right. And then we have the information grid. I see people in their online life and their followers and they're followed and they're nervously watching screens instead of interacting with real people around them as much. Are we becoming encapsulated, sort of separated like hermits who believe they are part of an online crowd?
Yeah, I think new technologies I don't think are inherently bad or good. I would sort of defer to the way in which Deleuze likes to sort of think about these kinds of problems. And for him, it was all about, you know, how we put things to work. So in the case of technology, how do we use those technologies and the information that we get from them? And in the case of information, I think there's an added layer of whether or not the information is reliable or misleading. And we're very much in a digital information age. And the question of whether or not we can trust the information that we acquire from social media sites is key here. You know, during COVID, access to new technologies and the internet allowed a lot of people to stay connected and to continue their studies and continue working. But COVID also exposed a serious sort of digital deficit, is one way of putting it. You know, I was dean at the time at University of Texas in Dallas-Fort Worth, and many of our students at that institution were from, you know, underrepresented groups and were financially volatile. And the difficulty for me there was how to get laptops into those students' hands, but also how to get access to the internet for them so that they could continue their studies during the global pandemic. So, you know, as a dean, I felt deeply responsible and personally, you know, invested in solving that particular challenge, especially since I was also a first-generation student and I know, you know, how difficult it is to complete your studies and stay on track if you don't have the resources that you need in order to continue forward. So in that regard, the concern for me is like the digital divide, which is further deepening structures of inequity between those that have access to the internet and to some of the benefits that can come along with that and those that don't. So, you know, that's, of course, like a very different digital situation, I think, to someone who's overusing social media or is using it uncritically. And I think there's been some interesting studies that have been done, for example, on the pleasure that people experience and the systems of sort of reinforcement in things that we already believe in. Like, for example, we know that in the sort of space of social media, there's a feedback loop mechanism that's at play, because the way in which it functions is in response to things that you like. So, you know, I always find it amazing if I search for something on the internet and then next thing I know it's appearing in all my feeds as a prompt to purchase whatever it is I was sort of, you know, looking at. You know, that proves that in a way it's much like a sort of narcissistic structure. It's one that kind of feeds you what you want, and it's premised upon, you know, reading all those inputs that you've already created based upon, you know, clicks and likes and shares and so on and so forth. The harmful behaviour that's connected to the use of social media comes from an absence of critique. And in many ways, too, it can sort of amplify harmful behaviours and traits and tendencies that people might already have, to be like a social recluse or feelings of anxiety. Also, I think it's tied to feelings of powerlessness. You know, when you're starting to get inundated with a lot of the sort of bad news out there in the world, I can understand why sometimes the general population might feel like there's not much hope to change things. So it's a complicated terrain.
Well, some of us seek comfort in becoming a witness to the times, and science is partly about that. Why could the witness role be dangerous, do you think?
So why can this be dangerous? Well, it's because even, you know, a passive witness on, say, social media has material effects, namely when the information that they're absorbing is incorrect, a lie, or misleading, and a person acts upon it. So it's by being open, and I come back to this idea of critical thinking and engagement again, open to information that might falsify a particularly loud or visible piece of information that's being disseminated and reinforced on social media, I think, where the problems arising from misinformation and disinformation occur, like, you know, the January 6th riots on the Capitol Hill, right? So I suppose what I'm proposing here is a distinction between, like, active and passive witnessing. And the information that comes from passive witnessing, I don't really think it's very valid. I think it's deeply flawed, because in the absence of any critical engagement with the information that social media provides, that information is not that much different to hearsay, rumour, and, you know, even malice. So such a witness, in my view, would be incompetent. But in its worst form, passive witnessing facilitates and has facilitated historically, like, some of the world's greatest forms of violence. And, you know, here I'm thinking of multiple genocides that occurred over the course of human history.
10 years ago, you predicted not revolution in benign consciousness, but, quote, a more virulent strain of capital accumulation on the horizon. Adrian, that appears to be what has happened. Is there a way for it to end?
Yeah, I think that's certainly like a billion-dollar question at the moment, because the challenge is capital is a process. I've talked about that many times, and that's not an idea of mine. That's an idea that comes, you know, extends all the way back to Karl Marx, and has been spoken about by David Harvey. And the idea is, you know, that as a process, capital appropriates the limits that are set to it, including ecological limits. So, you know, at this point, I'd return to a quote by the cultural thinker, and I've used this quote a lot, of Frederick Jamson, who once noted that it's easier to imagine the end of the world than the end of capitalism. And so for me, imagination, as I discussed in Birth of a New Earth, is crucial in, you know, enabling us to try to move past the violence, the exploitation, and the oppression that global capitalism and militarism have given rise to.
You know, the German philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche wrote about good and evil, and he wound up in a hospital for the insane as he got older. And allegedly the incident that tipped him over the edge, the story anyway, is that Nietzsche saw a driver beating his dying horse on the street. Another instance of social insanity seems to have triggered pages of thought in your new book, Earthlings. Can you tell us why happy tourists taking selfies outside a caged polar bear was significant for you?
Yeah, I mean, the idea that people could happily pose in front of, like, a distressed, captured polar bear cub living inside a box with one wall of glass, which was situated inside a mall in China and was permanently on display, I think is profoundly disturbing to me, because I think it casts a light on the inhumanity of humanity, a humanity that's devoid of empathy and compassion, of the animal suffering that they were sort of narcissistically using as a backdrop to attract social media likes, shares, clicks, you know, so on and so forth. And those images of people happily posing before such an, you know, an example of abject misery really sums up, I think, the challenge that we have as a species in moving forward together to bring about environmental justice, not only for humans, but other than human species. I mean, if we're immune to suffering like that, and we're still, you know, we see it as our right to abuse the suffering of another for our own entertainment and enjoyment in this way, I think that strikes to the heart of the challenge that we collectively face when it comes to us arriving at the social change that will lead to environmental justice eventually. I mean, a narcissist is incapable of empathy, and without empathy, emancipatory imagination and inclusive politics and a basic sense of common values are all lost.
You wrote three books on the French philosopher Gilles Deleuze, and I'm wondering, do we still need the French school of deconstruction to understand the ecologic predicament and other predicaments in our society?
You know, I think there's so much in Deleuze and Guattari, and I'd like to bring Guattari into the picture as well, because a lot of work, the work that they wrote together, I find really useful in thinking about, you know, the ecological crisis that we're in and its connection to sort of militarism and globalism. And so I think, you know, their thinking is deeply ecological. And I think it's helpful in, you know, in us trying to sort of formulate a comprehensive understanding of this particular ecological predicament that we're finding ourselves in the 21st century. So, you know, for one, Deleuze's view of, how can I put this, like a differentiating being that's forever changing, but yet it's still one, right, is very much an idea at the heart of the theory of Gaia, for example, where that idea is that the world is like this singular organism that's self-differentiating. That has deep connections to me, for me, in Deleuze's thinking, like around difference and repetition and the role that difference plays in his theory of sort of ontology. And Deleuze and Guattari offer us a view of collaborative sociality that doesn't erase the singularity of individual differences to form this sort of ever-changing, what they call rhizomatic whole. But the social whole, so to speak, is changed through these processes of differentiation, which is basically a theory of inclusive political change, that one that's like not premised upon authoritarianism or sociality being collapsed into some other hierarchical formation. All singularity, all individual differences for Deleuze and Guattari are the effects of this kind of multiplicity of differences. And I think that's a really hopeful idea in our current condition, that those subsumed by individualism and competition, and it's certainly been something that's been very helpful for me as I've been thinking about processes of commoning and the role that that plays in social and political change.
Yes, I'm hearing this often in your work. Apocalyptic fears can consume us, and it must not replace positive imagination for a better world. Would you talk to us more about apocalyptic imagination and emancipatory imagination? How can we feed the good?
Yeah, so as I put those ideas forward, and I think it was in Birth of an Earth, towards the end there, I really laid out the distinction between these sort of two ideas. I was really leaning a lot on Hannah Arendt, and she once noted, you know, like the imagination is political because it enables us to enter the world and reality of another human being. And it pushes us out of our own worldview and into that of another person. And that's sort of connected to what I was saying earlier around the role of empathy too, right? So ultimately, Arendt, and I concur with her on this, there's no politics without being able to include another person's perspectives and experiences in your own view and orientation in the world. And I would add to Arendt, I bring in a trans-speciesist perspective there, and I think, you know, the same applies for the ways in which we try to imagine ourselves in the bodies of other animals and other species. So I think there's a lot in there in terms of forming a will and a collective commitment to peacefully live together with all of our differences. That said, you know, as I discussed in The Birth of a New Earth, imagination is not inherently liberatory. It can be repressive, or it can be emancipatory. So in order to, like, further unpack that idea, I looked to psychoanalysis and more specifically the structure of desire and repression and gratification. And in that context, apocalyptic imagination, as I was describing it, closes the future off to alterity, because it's premised upon this sort of insatiable appetite for gratification, a bit like what we were talking about before on sort of social media, you know, likes and clicks and shares and so forth. As that gratification is experienced through, you know, voyeurism, sensationalism, you know, the example of the selfies with the polar bear cub that was stuck in a mall, you know, permanently on display. So, you know, why is that closed? Well, because the imagination is stimulated to the point of terror, I think, or exhilaration. And that builds to this sort of crescendo that finds release in this happy ending minus the critique. So once again, we come back to this idea of critique and critical thinking and examination. And I think, you know, as a structure, apocalyptic imagination turns us inward, in on ourselves. But what we're needing with emancipatory imagination is this sort of act of commoning, a sort of a mode of distributing, like, feeling and memory and emotion and sensation to creatively and sensitively open us up to realities and experiences that are different to our own through the use of empathy and deep feeling, so that we can discover something new about ourselves through the experiences of another being, whether that is human being or another animal. And it allows us then to articulate and experience collective ways of being. So emancipatory imagination for me is central to, you know, other ideas that I've discussed around the role of commoning and empathy in building, you know, a sense of shared collective goals that we're all invested in together.
This is Radio EcoShock from the University of Oregon. We're speaking with Dean Adrian Parr about her new book, Earthlings: Imaginative Encounters with the Natural World. Well, you've talked about critical thinking and about emancipating ourselves with imagination. Are these things that can be taught and learned? How does this get spread out into society in the real world?
We all need to bring our different skill sets to bear in this process. I think, you know, artists have a role to play, philosophers have a role to play, just as much as policymakers, lawyers. There's certainly a really vibrant, growing movement of young people that are now taking the climate case to the courts and arguing that it's endangering the rights that they have to a future that's livable here on Earth. So I do think there are different ways in which we can certainly move the needle on this one so that we start moving together in a positive direction.
Adrian, you've noted right-wing growth in places like Spain, Germany, and the U.S., places where the left has been formerly strong. Even when people support eliminating subsidies for fossil fuels, millions of them vote for a climate denier as a leader. So the awful question becomes, what happens if the masses desire their own oppression? Your thoughts?
Well, we end up with more and more political leaders who are embraced not for exercising an inclusive and compassionate vision, but for being autocratic and divisive. And I think here Wilhelm Reich is incredibly helpful as we try to grapple with that phenomenon. In The Mass Psychology of Fascism, Reich connected social desire to the reinforcement of patriarchal and authoritarian social structures. And so basically he examined the role that repression and morality play in socialization and how that becomes a political condition that's conducive to the formation and mass support of authoritarian leaders. So, for instance, like a cruel society, not simply the fault, I would say, of an autocratic and cruel leader, I think that kind of leadership structurally aligns with the social field and what the social field desires. So, you know, the wish for authoritarian forms of state power then is linked to, I think, deeper experiences of how patriarchal power and authority are exercised. And that condition is integral to how we, as individuals, are socialized with, you know, the father figure who disciplines the family, for example, is what Reich wrote about. And that then becomes institutionalized in the form of, like, authoritarian rule and social repression.
But maybe we could find ardent environmentalists in some countries who see the time to save ourselves is so short. They might endorse a strong man or woman to dictate social and economic reform on a crash basis for the emergency. What if an authoritarian government is the only way to slash emissions and preserve the last pockets of nature? If that was the only way, would we do it? Or would we perish with our beliefs in democracy and freedom?
You know, I don't think authoritarianism is certainly going to be the way forward. in all of this. I think it's important that we're all able to collectively get on the same page and recognise that this is going to take a gargantuan collaborative effort in order to be successful.
Getting back to your ideas of reconnection, the Japanese have programs to reconnect with nature, with conscious walks in the woods, for example. And we know Aboriginal people in North America became other species in their clans, whether a raven or a turtle. It would be great if your technique of imagining life through other species, as you do so brilliantly in this book, if that could become a movement. Maybe this could be part of imagination work in schools and the workplace. Could it help if we could think like a tree or a butterfly?
Oh, I absolutely love this question. Thank you for asking it. Because I think, you know, writing Earthlings fundamentally changed me. Because it awoken me, well, it awoken me my lost child. The one that would naively spend hours watching bugs in the backyard and all manner of life. And what it felt like in slow motion. And what I discovered when I wrote the book, and as I was entering into the bodies of all these other species, all the while avidly, like, reading the science behind those material transformations that I was describing, was, like, this important role that temporality plays in invoking a trans-speciesist ethic. Because ultimately, as you imaginatively enter the body of another being, your own life rhythm changes. And more often than not, this involves slowing down in order to become more aware. So the short answer to your question is yes, absolutely it would help if we could activate affect in this way, and that if we could, like, feel and sense like other species. I think it would deepen our empathy.
A scholar like yourself is part of an intellectual organism consisting of other minds, both living and dead. Who are your contemporaries? Who is part of the Adrian Parr Network?
Well, definitely Santiago Zabala. He's my dear, dear friend and intellectual friend for many, many years. We've written together. We edit a book series together with McGill University Press. We've appeared many times together in public talks and interviews. So I deeply respect his work. Rosie Bray Dotty is also another dear intellectual friend and colleague for many, many years. I first met Rosie when I was putting together the Deleuze Dictionary that would have been 25 years ago now. So that's been a really long intellectual and enriching friendship, and I'm so deeply indebted to her work on posthumanism. I think Brad Evans's work on violence has also, I'm very indebted to that work, and he and I have also had many collaborations together. There are also, though, a lot of artists and designers who I'm also really indebted to. You know, David Rothenberg's work, he's a philosopher artist who plays with other than human species, makes music with them. I mean, incredible, incredible work. Mitch Joachim of Terraform One, the architecture firm, does a lot of trans species as design work in the built environment that I really admire. So I think, you know, there's a broad span of people there. I mean, last but not least, I'd have to mention my aunt, Julie Rapp, who's a contemporary artist in Australia, and my father, Mike Park, who's also a contemporary artist. I mean, I was really fortunate to be brought up in a very open but also, you know, I would describe a somewhat radical environment as an only child, and, you know, spending a lot of time in the studios of both my aunt and my father and learning the benefits that come from, you know, emotion and bringing that into play in the spaces of making things.
Well, reading the book Earthlings, I'm inspired by your insight, but I can't really find a solid take-home message for our listeners. Like a guru, you don't seem to offer a how to get out of this manual. You just make us think. Is that the point?
I think so. I think it's really important that we're able to be clear about what the challenges are. But I also think the new book, Earthlings, is a different kind of book. And I might, you know, I think I've got a copy here, and I think it would be helpful to just maybe read the last little paragraph in the introduction, because I think this helps in answering your question. You know, in it I write, art and literature invite us to come alive. Medicine and science try to keep us alive. The law tells us how to live. Politics questions how we live. Religion hopes to give us something to live for. Philosophy pursues how living and nothingness work, tempting us to explore what we love most about life. And the book that I wrote is really a little of all of these things, and hopefully it's something more.
From the University of Oregon, we've been speaking with public intellectual, author, and documentary maker, Dr. Adrienne Parr. Look for her new book, Earthlings, Imaginative Encounters with the Natural World. You can find more links to follow up in my show blog at ecoshock.org.